This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It, ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheezit-aktion.de.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In the virtual chamber that is the Briefing Room, you and I have 28 minutes to get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, the psychological impact of the coronavirus lockdown. Let's go. Like the first shoots of spring, some European countries are easing a few of their lockdown restrictions. In Denmark, kindergartens welcome their children back. Non-food shops open their doors in some parts of Italy. In Austria, it's bookshops. Not here, though. At some point, it'll be our turn, but not yet. So I want to know about how the pandemic is affecting us psychologically, how long we can cope with lockdown, and what mental impact the experience will have on us in the long term. Step inside the Briefing Room and together we'll find out. First to China, where lockdown started in January, lasted 3 months and has only recently been eased. China had been here before in a much more limited way during the SARS outbreak of 2002 to 2003. Dr. George Hu is a clinical psychologist at the United Family Pudong Hospital in Shanghai. China experienced a lockdown at the time of the SARS epidemic. What do we know about how people came out of that lockdown?
The effects range, and particularly the mental health effects range. Anxiety and fear are very, very common effects. Many of your listeners may have heard of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, which is one of the ways in which stress reactions can occur. But there's another reaction called acute stress reaction, which refers to the type of reaction that people have in the initial stages after a traumatic experience. The threat or the fear of contracting a life-threatening illness, the experience of perhaps a family member or a loved one or a close friend contracting a life-threatening illness and perhaps even passing away can be considered traumatic.
Now, some of these are about simply the fear of illness itself and the experience of death. Were any of them related to the business of actually being locked down and in quarantine?
People can experience a decreased frustration tolerance. Frustration tolerance really is our ability to tolerate frustration in our lives. If we utilize our frustration tolerance abilities on one thing, being locked down, there's less of it left over for other things. Managing our families, or managing our work, or managing our social relationships, or managing our finances. And so people find that they experience other difficulties related to frustration tolerance and temper.
In other words, essentially, we can take it out on our families.
That is very, very true, particularly when our families are the only people that we see 24/7. For most people, we don't actually see them as much as we're seeing them right now.
Now, the lockdown in China this time has lasted, 3 months, didn't it? And was more stringent, I think, than in many other countries. Were citizens able to walk about the streets if they were distanced? Were they able to take outside exercise?
No, largely not. Many live in these sort of high-rise housing complexes. Depending on the type of compound you lived in, you may not have been allowed to go outside of that compound. And in some compounds, you couldn't even leave the building.
So what are you beginning to see as people emerge from that lockdown? What kind of mental shape do you see them being in?
There is an initial sense of elation or euphoria. Experiencing normal life again and going out to the restaurants or the stores or the establishments that they're used to going to or seeing the people physically that they wanted to see. But it can be pretty quickly followed by a sort of sense of sadness or melancholia. And a lot of that is because people are experiencing that to one extent or the other, this phase is different from pre-coronavirus. And there's a sense of grief. They're unsure whether some of their favorite establishments that they used to frequent with their friends will make it through this, will survive. They're unsure whether their friends or their social connections will be able to stay where they are. Maybe they would have to move due to job or financial reasons. And so life is likely to profoundly change in many ways. There's a certain amount of grief and sadness and mourning associated with that.
You're talking about something where people emerge from a situation that was unprecedented, and they've gone through unprecedented anxiety, strain, and disruption. What kind of facilities have the Chinese authorities made available in terms of mental health assistance in order to try and help people through the aftermath?
Mental health resources are famously thin in most of the world. That's as true here as anywhere else. Oftentimes, there are not enough mental health resources to meet the true needs of the population. I do think that as we are coming out of a quarantine here in China, I do believe that we will enter into the next phase in which the mental health needs of the population will become more and more salient. And I do think if China can respond to the mental health needs in the way that China was able to rapidly respond to physically contain this outbreak, I do think that that would benefit the population profoundly.
George Hu in Shanghai. So what do we know right now about what's happening psychologically to people here? And let's look at that in two parts. First, I want to find out what's happening to vulnerable people, such as those of us who have pre-existing mental health conditions, or addictions, or difficult home lives. Helen Westerman is a safeguarding expert who, soon after the outbreak began, was drafted in to help Childline.
The coronavirus crisis obviously has created new risks for some children. So we're hearing from some children for the first time. Children are telling us that they're experiencing anxiety, depression. A child in particular that talked about not being able to get out of bed, never felt as desperate as she had done at the minute. Also talking to children who are experiencing self-harm, wanting to end their own lives. It's also added, I think, to the risks facing other children that we would perhaps regularly have contact with, so perhaps more vulnerable children. We work with families who are coping with lots of different issues. So that could be parental mental health, drug and alcohol problems, poverty, real social isolation. Children will be very concerned that there's no end in sight to this. And just last week, we had an increase of 9% in contacts about domestic abuse to our helpline. Without formal support from social care, local authority, schools, health, actually that becomes a really toxic mix for a family that perhaps otherwise would have managed day to day. We had understood that approximately 400,000 pupils had been identified by the Department of Education as children in need and therefore should be in school, but we know much fewer are attending schools. For some children, the school is a place of safety. Home is not always the safest place for a child to be. So a child going into school, having regular contact with teachers, designated safeguarding leads, keeping an eye on that child, their emotional, mental health is a positive thing. When a child doesn't have that, it becomes quite difficult to know what's happening for that child, what's happening for that family. It's really challenging for all services that have an input into vulnerable families at the moment. I mean, working with families remotely using technology has a place, and we know that teams are using technology effectively with some children and with some families, but some families do need that face-to-face visit. The long-term impacts of the coronavirus outbreak on vulnerable children will exacerbate the issues that they're already experiencing day to day. So for those children, this will be an extremely difficult time for them, and it will be a case of providing ongoing support, intensive support perhaps, for those children once we come out of that. We think that we've got a potential generation of children that are very vulnerable following this epidemic.
Helen Westerman. Next, how are the rest of us coping? King's College London has collaborated with polling company Ipsos Mori to try and answer that. Bobby Duffy is Professor of Public Policy and Director of the Policy Institute at King's. Bobby Duffy, what proportion of people did you think are finding lockdown psychologically difficult already?
Yeah, we asked a very specific question on what proportion of people were finding it extremely difficult. And the response to that question was 15% were finding it extremely difficult currently. And a further 14% said it was very likely or certain that it's going to become more difficult for them over the next 1 to 4 weeks. And then the kind of people who are struggling more, 6% of people, which is quite a chunk of the population, said they've phoned counselling or support services during the lockdown because of the lockdown.
Are particular groups finding it more difficult than others?
Yes, the thing that stands out is it's quite generational, with younger people finding it more difficult than older people. So 4 in 10 teenagers and young adults say they're already finding it extremely difficult or expect it to be difficult within a short period of time. The other group of people that find it extremely difficult are those with more financial constraints. So those on lower incomes and those who are saying that they're already finding it difficult to buy essential goods. There's also a strong relationship with the self-employed as well, finding it more difficult. And you can understand why the lockdown will be affecting their income more directly than people who are employees. At the other end of the spectrum, there is a quarter of people who say that regardless of how long it went on, they wouldn't find it extremely difficult.
So really?
That is much more likely to be older groups who say, actually, it doesn't go on for as long as you like.
That's interesting, because that group is actually bigger than the group that's finding it tough. Does that surprise you?
Yes, that is a key aspect of the survey, is actually people are, for the most part, getting on with it. There are a few reasons for that, I think. Definitely, there is an element where we are just very unified in dealing with this terrible virus. And one of the other findings from the survey is that 9 in 10 people support the lockdown measures. But within that, 7 in 10 of us strongly support the lockdown measures. And I've been looking at public opinion for about 25 years. You just about never find 7 in 10 Brits strongly supporting anything. Really, one of the only exceptions to that is when you ask them about the NHS. 7 in 10 people or more strongly support the NHS. And that gives you some idea of part of the reason why we're so unified in this. We can see the pressure on the NHS. So that lockdown support, which stands out as an extraordinary thing, is directly related to the love and connection we have with the health service.
Does the poll measure the extent to which people think, and the NHS might be part of this, somehow we are all in this together?
The other aspect that brings us together is our perception of the risk involved in coronavirus. And I've been studying people's perceptions and misperceptions of risk for a long time. And one of the things that stands out about coronavirus is that people have either an incredibly accurate view of the risks involved with coronavirus, or actually, if they are wrong, they tend to overestimate the risks involved. So when you ask people, if you got the coronavirus, what's your chances of having to go into hospital? The average guess is, so each individual on average thinks there's a 30% chance they'll have to go to hospital. Now, we don't actually know as yet what the hospitalization rate for this disease is, but the Imperial College model that spurred the government into action assumed 4.4%. We think it's 7 times higher. And that sense of danger is very consistent across the population. And that's very unifying as well for people.
Do people behave differently if they don't accept that it's the threat that most people think it is, or imagine something else about it?
Yeah, around 14% of people think there's too much fuss being made about the virus. Equally, we do have a quarter of people who think that the virus was probably created in a lab. Those people are similarly much more dismissive of the measures and less supportive of the government and less bothered about the whole epidemic overall. It's really about an underlying view of authority, and those people are much less likely to comply with just about anything the government asks them to do.
So we're unified in the perception of risk to us. How far are we unified by the sense that everybody else is just having to do what we're having to do?
that is key to it, that we are in this together, that people are facing the same difficulties and the same measures. We've been incredibly unified on our way in for the measures themselves. What's going to be much more difficult is how we come out. As soon as it starts to develop differently for different groups, where the measures are eased for some groups and not for others, that strength of unifying public opinion is going to dissipate. We are much more likely to see a fragmentation in people's opinion and support on the way out than we were on the way in, when we were all being treated the same.
Presumably, any government advisor or minister reading that section of the polls will think, well, we have to be incredibly careful then about how we frame the idea of coming out of lockdown.
Yes, and you can see that in government communications. They're being incredibly careful in not giving very clear signals of exactly what's going to happen and when.
Professor Bobby Duffy with a snapshot of the here and now. The next thing I want to know is how we're likely to cope with more weeks of the lockdown and how we can be helped through it. Stephen Reicher is Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of St Andrews. He's been advising the UK and Scottish governments. Stephen Reicher, we just heard from Professor Duffy that most people so far, as polled, seem to be coping quite well and also exhibiting a high level of compliance. Now, are you surprised at all by that?
Well, when I started doing research on behaviour in disasters and emergencies, yes, I would have been surprised. But as time went by and the more disasters and emergencies I looked at and studied, we began to find that actually these forms of mutual support, these forms of social responsibility are actually very common indeed. And I think the reason for it, when people experience common fate, in other words, they're all in the same boat together, they develop a sense of shared identity. And that sense of shared identity begins to lead them to act not for their individual good, but for the common and for the social good.
Now, one of the things you'll probably have come across very often is the assumption, essentially, that human beings and human psychology is frail, that it really doesn't take much to knock us off. How does that play out in a time like this?
My experience of being involved in various committees around various things over a number of years is also it's a very popular view in government. After all, it justifies government. It tells them that we, the population, need them to look after us. If we didn't, then they'd be redundant. One of the dangers of that viewpoint is, first, that you don't trust the public. You fear that if you communicate too much, well, they won't be able to cope with it. So it leads you to give less information to people. And the problem is that if you don't give information to people, you communicate that you don't trust them and you don't respect them. And if you communicate lack of trust and lack of respect, you break a link with the public. So I think it's problematic in that regard. The second reason why it's problematic is you begin to see the public as the problem.
So what would that tell us about how the government could look at enforcing or facilitating things in periods of lockdown?
Well, I think the distinction you made between enforcing and facilitating is really important. For many years, I did work on crowd behaviour, and we looked at public order policing. And we found that a number of years ago, there was a dominant view that, look, crowds are a problem, crowds are out of control, crowds are danger, therefore the attitude was all enforcement. And when the police tried to enforce things on the crowd as a whole, it would often create the very disorder they were trying to stop. So again, start off from the assumption, which is empirically grounded, that most people want to adhere. So the starting point shouldn't be waving a big stick at people and saying, you've got to stay indoors or else. It's to say, okay, what are the constraints on people, the practical constraints, and how can we help them to achieve what they want to achieve and what we want to achieve? Let me give you just one very simple example indeed. We've seen over the last few weeks lots of headlines about people, especially in London, going out into the park and getting too close to each other. And the response, to some extent, has been to say, you idiots, this is madness. But if you start off from a facilitative point of view, then what you say is, OK, how do we open up green spaces? How do we then, for instance, allow people to go for walks on private golf courses or on playing fields and so on? The very simple shift, but it's a very powerful shift which leads you to ask very different types of questions and come up with very different types of solutions. What are the spaces to which, for instance, people suffering from abuse could go? Can we use the hotels that are currently empty in order to give people safe spaces? So I think there is a role for much more creative thinking.
One of the things that people are talking about is before we've discovered the vaccine and we can use it, those people particularly at biological risk might be asked to maintain themselves in lockdown. And I was wondering whether we knew anything about the psychological effect upon people of such a prolonged period of isolation.
Well, the thing we know very clearly is isolation is bad for you. In fact, it's been estimated the physical effects of isolation are roughly equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So the question is, how can we physically distance without socially isolating? Now, we are seeing, I think, the emergence of all sorts of really creative forms of people doing things together. We've seen online choirs. We're beginning to see communities coming together using both virtual but also good old-fashioned forms of communication that have virtually died a death. I think letter writing is beginning to reemerge. So as we go forward and the longer this happens, I think that comes back to a question for the government, which is a facilitative question. So it would be a good idea, for instance, to approach the telephone companies and make sure that nobody is cut off for not paying their bills for the period of the lockdown. Not everybody has got the technology. They don't all have the tablets and they don't all have the Wi-Fi. How are we going to deal with those types of questions in order to support people with the forms of technology which allow such connections to take place?
And finally, how important is it to know, not just to know that there's probably going to be light at the end of the tunnel, but to have a reasonable idea of when that light will come? Do people crave certainty in that way?
There was recently a very interesting study which looked at the role of scientific communication, which was posed either in absolute terms or in more probabilistic terms. And what it found was that people are actually rather open to people saying, look, we can't tell you exactly because there are certain things we don't know. What's more, it makes them trust the scientists more, because the danger is that if you pose things in absolute terms, this is true, that's not true, this will happen now, that will happen then if it changes, you switch over from absolute belief to absolute disbelief. But if you say this is the best knowledge we have at the moment, and to give you more would be misleading, I think people can cope with that.
Professor Stephen Reicher. And finally, what do we know about the impact that crises like this have on people once normal life resumes? Professor Neil Greenberg is a consultant occupational and forensic psychiatrist. He served in the armed forces and worked as a psychiatrist and researcher in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's currently working at London's Nightingale Hospital in the Excel Centre. In fact, he's speaking from what was, and hopefully will again be, the Costa Coffee Cafe there. Neil Greenberg, let's continue to the period after quarantine. We've heard that for certain groups of people, this may very well give rise to expressed mental health problems. How might we begin to respond to those?
So you're absolutely right. There are definitely groups of more vulnerable people who can be affected by the current situation, particularly people who have mental health problems before. Now, in terms of going forward, they are going to need plenty of care. But there's also lots of others, you know, those who have had serious infections and have recovered, you know, who have had probably a traumatic experience. And then there's also those who are essential key workers. You know, we think of healthcare workers, but there are also many others who are doing really challenging tasks. I mean, perhaps one of the groups that are highlighted particularly recently a lot in the media are those who work in rest homes and care homes, who are going to no doubt be finding the current situation really difficult to cope with, given that so many of the residents are getting ill and at risk of dying. So when you put that all together, I think there definitely is going to be a need for increased mental health support. And I use the term support in its proper term, because I'm not suggesting for a moment that everybody is going to need lots of formal mental health treatment from a mental health professional. But I do think that as a nation and as employers of essential workers, there's going to have to be some thought put into not just returning to normal as if this didn't happen.
One group, obviously, you've been working with most is health workers. I mean, those people who've been dealing directly with people suffering. And we've heard a lot of talk about them and the pressures upon them. But thinking about them in the context of the post-lockdown period and the post-pandemic period, what will they suffer from and what can we usefully do to help them?
Yes, many of them are on the front line, to use a militaryism, and are doing amazing work in really, really challenging situations. And it's easy to think about the potential to suffer with mental health problems, which is a real potential, and no doubt a lot of them will find this quite challenging. But the flip side to this is also that many people in those situations actually find that they cope well with adversity. And there is a concept which is known as post-traumatic growth, which is, you know, summed up really by anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so many of the healthcare staff who are doing these amazing work at the moment may well find that actually that they weren't entirely sure they could do it beforehand. But having done it, their personal resilience and quite rightly sense of self-satisfaction may be quite elevated. And so many may actually come out of this, if done properly, feeling much stronger than they were before. The challenge here is that when we go from the sort of sustain phase where we're in now, where people are working really hard to save lives, into the recover phase, is that the recover phase is done in the right way. When we look at traumatic events, we know that the most important predictors of whether people do well or not is not actually how nasty the trauma is, but it's how well people are supported as they try to recover from the trauma. And what that tells me is that when we begin to try to go back to whatever the new normal is, that actually the healthcare organisations can't just say, right, okay, we need to get back to business, have a weekend, and then we've got to come in and catch up with all these operations and outpatient appointments that we haven't been doing for the last few months. There's going to have to be a recognition that a graded return to work, it's going to take, you know, some days, weeks or months, and that we really risk damaging staff an awful lot if we don't get that recover phase right. What it means is that the NHS needs to perhaps set the expectation of the public that actually, I'm really sorry that you've been waiting for your operation or your outpatient or whatever it is, but actually you can't expect things to get back to normal straight away.
Do you think there are any lessons from that approach for other areas of work and other occupations where people might be expected to come straight from lockdown and whatever they've been through and hit it? Maybe even with a kind of redoubled vigour, when actually that might be tricky for them.
You can see why employers would be saying, you know, we haven't made any money in the last few months. We need to really catch up to make our year-end figures look good. I think there is a real danger in just assuming that people have got to make up for the 3 or 4 months that have been missed out, because we know that the support and stresses that people experience after challenging events are the strongest predictors of whether they go on to become ill or not.
Professor Neil Greenberg, my conclusions are almost too many to list. We've obviously been living through a concentrated human experiment, and as the results of it emerge, those that govern us and those that run our services must be responsive to what we learn from it. My thanks to George Hu, Helen Westerman, Bobby Duffy, Stephen Reicher and Neil Greenberg. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Darren Graham and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Never Miserian and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you enjoyed it or found it useful, you may find other episodes interesting, including the inequalities of lockdown and coronavirus from testing to vaccine.